This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Timps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about perfectionism with Shana Norwood. Before we talk a little bit more about her, we'll start off with a definition for perfectionism from the Cambridge English Dictionary. That is, the wish for everything to be correct or perfect. So perfectionism is something we wanted to cover for a little while on the podcast, the link between that and mental health. So to highlight that, I do have an extract of an article from Psychology Today that I wanted to read from. Perfectionism is a trait that makes life an endless report card on accomplishments or looks, a fast and enduring track to unhappiness. It is often accompanied by depression and eating disorders. What makes perfectionism so toxic is that while those in its grip desire success, they are in fact most focused on avoiding failure, so theirs is a negative orientation. They expect others' love and approval to be conditional on a flawless performance. So I really love that as a way of illustrating how close that link is and how certain conditions in fact seem really attuned to perfectionism to an extent where it can be quite hard to draw the lines of what is symptoms of a mental illness, like anxiety we'll be talking about a lot today. So where is the line of what's anxiety around completing your work and getting things done to the best of your ability versus perfectionism, where you're trying to achieve this unattainable, ever-moving goal, and that in itself can create anxiety.
Yeah, it's opened up a whole can of thought and learning for me doing this research. I didn't realise, I don't think, how intrinsically linked it was to mental illness, actually.
Yeah, like many of the factors in mental health that we talk about on the show, it's one where when you actually think about it, it's really obvious that people acknowledge it in a kind of abstract way of like, oh yeah, of course that stresses people out and that's a mental health thing. But when you actually delve into it deeper, there's such an integral link. And even like with many of the episodes actually where we talk about work, I'm constantly finding more and more how deep work being a coping mechanism goes for me. And so certainly you'll hear in the interview segment me really relating to the guest on that and us having actually a very similar approach to work at times. So I definitely learned a lot as well about how much perfectionism influences my life in general, but also can interact with my depression as well, because it means on my worst days, it helps justify the depression, that I'm not meeting the perfectionism, and therefore the depression is more valid.
Valid, yeah. And that's interesting because actually on the same day while researching, my daughter came home and she was doing some colouring with my other daughter, and said, no, it has to be like that. I'm just a perfectionist. And I'd literally stopped that. I'd been working on this that day. And I was like, Ella, no, you're not, straight away. But, she, you know, it was interesting that it's talked about, not really with much understanding of what it really means and the impact it has, actually.
Right, for sure, that it's often seen as something really aspirational.
Yeah.
That, like, we should all be perfectionists. And actually, it's not. The more you delve into it, the more you see that it's looking for something unattainable. And without too much recovering the ground of the interview, we do touch a bit on that, about that link with happiness, that there has to be a point where you're happy enough with your work. Otherwise, you'll never get joy from your own productivity.
Ever, because it's unrealistic, as you said, unattainable. But a couple of things that I wanted to mention. One was, As you know, and I talk about a lot on the podcast, but my background and still my life is in sport. And as an athlete, perfectionism seems to be what you strive for. I mean, like we've talked in other, you know, business as well, but Ronaldo, the late Kobe Bryant, David Beckham will all talk about, well, I was a perfectionist. When they're interviewed, I was a perfectionist. I'd be the last one in the gym. I'd be the first one there. I'd be doing free kicks over and over and over again. I'd be practicing my three-point shot. Like, and for young aspiring athletes, you think, well, this is what I've got to do.
Right.
And it doesn't, so it's made me question a lot about what I think about it, actually, because as a coach as well, I would say to my children and the kids that I coach, to be the best you can be, you need to keep practicing, you need to do this, you need to do that. But actually, I think it's fine, what they were saying, this is the conclusion that I've come to anyway, but maybe using the term perfectionist isn't necessarily the way we'd want to move forward with that. So it's fine that they were the last ones in the gym, fine that they were the first ones there, they wanted to get it right. Whether or not that's a perfectionist, if we actually break down and know what the word means, maybe that's the thing, using that term.
Right, that perhaps the word perfect being in it implies that far too strongly that there is such a thing as a perfect.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when you're talking about sports people, I think about someone like Usain Bolt. And, you know, the perfection in that situation may be that he sets a new world record. But then as soon as he's done that, it's on to, okay, what's the next one he's going to break? Yeah. Or is he going to better his own record? So that even a sport where it is so finite that there's, you know, point this many seconds,
yeah,
there's still no such thing as perfectionism. It's still evolving constantly. Yeah. And in that way, you're sort of setting yourself up to fail by being a perfectionist. Instead, why not focus on the hard work that these sports people have to put in that are really why they're there? Because we all understand, we're under no illusion that they just happen to be like gifted and that's it. Mm-hmm. They may be gifted going into the sport, but it's the work that gets them to Olympic level.
Absolutely. And maybe it's the determination and that real raw fight to be the best they can be is what they're talking about, more than, well, I was a perfectionist, so I wouldn't have even got it right. Because I reckon if we interviewed each of them now and said to any of them, unfortunately, we wouldn't be able to interview Kobe. But if we interviewed, for example, Ronaldo, I'm sure he would say now, if you said, was any of it perfect, he'd probably say no.
Mm.
As much as he'd say, I'm a perfectionist, and he's, you know, people say he's one of the best footballers ever lived, would he say that any of his achievements or any of his kicks or any of his goals were perfect? Probably not. He'd say there was something else he could have always done.
Right.
So perfectionism isn't why he's become the best in the world. It was his dogged determination and his work rate, and that's different.
For sure. And I think that's pretty universal.
Yeah.
Whatever you're highly achieving, uh-huh, in, there is that mentality of constantly finding the flaws. And that's really what perfectionism comes down to, and why I like that previous part of the article I read out, that a lot of the danger is in the negative focus. You're always finding flaws in your work, in your approach, in your achievements. And it's a very negative way to look at life. And
yeah,
in that way, being successful at perfectionism is being successful in constantly finding flaws and picking yourself apart.
Yeah.
And
it's a great way to say it, actually.
And if that's not anxiety inducing, yeah, I don't know what is.
Yeah.
As we'll explore in the interview, that link is so clear with our guest. And it's tricky because she does accredit this with a lot of her success and how hard she's worked. But she's now in a place where she's trying to move beyond that,
mm,
and find healthier ways of approaching her work. And so that's really great to hear that kind of evolution.
Yeah.
I found really inspirational.
Yeah.
And so just before we get into the interview with Shayna, which I really enjoyed, got two last stats as well. So the first one is from research at West Virginia University into child development and perfectionism. And they found that 2 in 5 kids and adolescents are perfectionists. So I thought that was a really interesting stat in terms of how young this type of approach to life can start, which I think is often, as I'm sure we could talk about all day, perpetuated by the school system as well, that it is a very linear way of learning where everything comes with a grade ultimately,
yeah,
when you leave school. And so in that way, it doesn't surprise me, but it's interesting to hear how prevalent it is from so young. And they further went on to find that generally increases through people's lives as they get older as well. And then the last one, from a study reviewed in Medical News Today in 2018, found that over half of people who died by suicide in their study were described by their loved ones as perfectionists.
Mm.
So that one I found particularly sobering and really reminded me of what we've talked about recently on the podcast, of the sort of wording people can use when they're trying to come to terms with mental illness.
Yeah.
Certain people will describe themselves as being a worrier, before they describe themselves as having anxiety. There can be kind of softer language we use. I guess while we're still coming to terms with things, and even people in my own life will refer to like feeling blue rather than feeling depressed. A lot of this language can feel more comfortable. And so this seems to be a really concerning parallel, that when people are talking about being perfectionists in terms of their life, and particularly if they feel they're underachieving and failing at life, this stat, over half of people who died by suicide were described by their loved ones as perfectionists, may be a real clear warning sign that we're missing out on. You know, we acknowledge that certain behaviours can be signs of mental illnesses. Maybe it's time we start noticing that a perfectionist approach to life can actually be a sign that people are at risk of suicidal feelings as well. Feelings of failure contributing to a feeling that their whole life may be a failure, and that there may not be a way to turn things around and get through the ways in which they may feel they're letting everyone down.
Absolutely. Well put, Bobby. And I think it is a red flag. And we said it at the top of the show, you know, labeling yourself as a perfectionist, or people saying she's a perfectionist, he's a perfectionist, whatever, isn't necessarily positive. And we need to recognize, looking at that stat, that actually, let's just, especially for the younger children, let's just take note of what that means. And, you know, I try to put Ella right and say, what is a perfectionist? I'm having this conversation with a 9-year-old. There's no such thing, Ella, you know, nobody's ever going to be perfect. It's, you know, blah, blah, blah. But you're right. And that's that, you know, over half of the people want to be perfect. And if they're not, then these thoughts are coming in. It can also be appearing perfect to the social world. Feelings of that social prescribed perfectionism was the biggest increase for young people in the last 3 years.
Right. That's really interesting, because I definitely do think, in the same way people really grapple with understanding social media's influence in people's lives.
I mean, I even heard someone on the train the other day, two girls, teenagers, talking about like the caption that they were writing with their post. I mean, I've even done it before, you know, it's taken me a second. But, you know, I want it to be funny. Oh, no, that sounds terrible. Oh, my God, I can't write that. Like, they were having this whole thing, the whole journey, like 20 minutes on the train, making sure that the caption was perfect. It's got to be perfect, she's saying to a friend. She's like, well, it's just not funny. Well, I think it's funny. Well, they're having this massive thing about the caption, you know? And I just thought, wow, how important it is to them that they appear funny or witty or whatever on social media.
It is madness. And that's ultimately what we're trying to say here. Sorry if you're listening and you feel that we're taking the word perfectionist away from you. But
yeah,
but it is really important distinction, because at its worst, it can compromise someone's entire sense of self.
Yeah.
That if they're not performing at a way which they believe is perfect, which we don't really believe exists anyway, then they'll be questioning who they are. Are they completely failing at life and failing those around them if they're not achieving this unachievable set of requirements?
Mm-hmm.
It's a difficult approach to live in. And so that's why we're so glad to be covering it. And it's definitely something that I've been guilty of, branded myself as a perfectionist in the past and worn it like a badge of honour, you know, and that's very much the type of hard working that I was brought up with, that you'd give everything your absolute most. And I agree with that, but I've learned that there's still ways I can improve that approach. So I absolutely believe in hard work, but I'm working to get better at not doing it to the extent where it compromises my health.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I've completed what I need to do, I'm trying harder to not look back and immediately pick it apart.
Yeah.
And see how could I make it better next time. You know, there's a level of that that's useful, and there's a level of that that's kind of obsessive. And that's what we're really getting at here.
Yeah, find that line, Bobby Temps.
We'll definitely talk about that more in the interview as well. So Shayna is one of our new international guests. She was a real delight to speak to. And I feel like we really got in depth into this conversation, and she realised a few things even as she was talking and explaining her relationship with perfectionism and with her mental health in general. I always love interviewing business people as well. There's a lot I can relate to, being self-employed myself. So, yeah, what a wonderful guest. And she has loads of incredible products that relate to mental health, which we talk about at the end of the episode as well, which I'd really recommend checking out. So for now, we'll get into the episode with Shayna Norwood, but first... Who's our sponsor? Let's find out. Ahead of International Women's Day on Sunday, we have a new partnership with The Economist, who are highlighting the stories of remarkable women this week. In fact, the publication actually covers a really broad range of topics every week, far beyond economics. For example, I read a fascinating article recently that contrasted how marriage contracts can limit the rights of women across different countries. In a time when the facts matter more than ever, it's a great read to cut through the noise and focus on the proactive news that matters. Plus, you can get a free print copy as one of our listeners. Just text HEALTH to 78070. That's the word HEALTH to 78070. Details are also in the episode description. There is no obligation from this free offer, so I'd really recommend trying an issue. And when you support our sponsors, you're supporting us too. Full details are in the episode description. The Economist, an essential guide to the forces changing your world.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
My name is Shayna Norwood, and I started understanding what mental health was at a very young age because my mom is a therapist. So she had her own private practice and like met with people in our house and kind of would explain things to me. It was just in the air and in the house. So I kind of always knew what it was. And I also knew that it was something that my mother struggled with. So she explained her experience with depression with me. And I don't remember a specific moment. It was just kind of always in my life.
So that's really interesting. I imagine it was nice for you coming from that background of having at least a basic understanding of mental health through your mother. Did you find that helpful when it came to your own experiences of mental illness?
I would say yes and no. Yes, in that I understood what it was as a concept, but no, in that you can understand the concept, but you don't really know what it feels like to go through it until you do. Right. So for me, even though I understood the idea of it, experiencing it was a whole new experience. And yeah, so I still struggled a lot with kind of equating that to what I was going through, for sure.
Mm-hmm. And where did symptoms first come up for you?
When I was 14 or 15, I had some sort of existential crisis, I guess, where I kind of like the conclusion that I came to is that like, what's the meaning of life? Nothing really means anything. If it doesn't mean anything, then, and it's all just in our heads, then why are we even alive? Kind of was the thought process that I went through to get to this crisis. And I kind of lost an understanding of there is any meaning to life at all. And I remember I actually said something to a friend of mine of like, you know, well, if we're not alive or if our lives don't matter, why are we even alive or something like that? And so she took me to a guidance counselor at school. And then at that point, I kind of realized like, oh, not everyone feels these things or thinks this way, and that it can be alarming for someone who's 14 or 15 to say there's no meaning to life.
Right. And so when you had that experience with the friend, were you concerned about your own coping at the time, or was that sort of news to you that they had these concerns?
I thought it was normal that everybody woke up and questioned why they were alive, because that was the only experience I had had, but clearly it was not. So I guess I learned to not really talk about what I was going through because it might be misinterpreted. I didn't want to go through that experience again.
Right. And that must have been really tough, particularly coming from a household with your mom, where I imagine it would have been very supportive of these types of conversations.
I just think it's like when you say something like suicide or not like I don't want to live, then it just alarms go off. And so there can be a very like reactionary environment, which in my head, I was just kind of sharing my viewpoint on the world. But, and I understand why it should be alarming. But I felt like there was an in-between of like, oh, I just feel this every day rather than like, I actually have a plan and I'm going to go through with it. And I think kind of trying to understand those differences, you need to do it in like a calm setting rather than like, oh my God, send them to the psych ward, you know? And that was kind of what I felt like I experienced.
For sure. And I think that's really common because people just don't know how to have these conversations.
Right, yeah.
They'll automatically think of the worst case scenario, whereas there are many people that can feel suicidal in theory as opposed to practice, you know,
right,
that would never
yeah.
go as far as making a plan.
Right, right.
May I ask to what level you were feeling suicidal at that time?
Just thoughts, just kind of like, meh, why am I alive? What do I have to do to not live? But not actual, like, what do I need to do to not live? Just as like a passing thought.
Yeah. So it sounds like they were very much jumping in with a more extreme type of reaction than you needed, really.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
How did things go from there?
I just stopped talking about it and denied it.
Right.
And then pretended that I didn't feel that way because I felt like it was misunderstood. So I kind of just like white knuckled it, I guess, after that.
And so you've mentioned that you were kind of surviving. You were just getting on with it and keeping a lot of this stuff bottled up. How
yeah.
long was it you were able to do that for?
Till I was in college. And that was when I had, I would say, my first episode. My second year in college, so I must have been like 20 years old. And I don't know what caused it, but I just had a lot of pressure on myself to, you know, really work really hard and push myself beyond what I was capable of. And I started not sleeping. I kind of knew that I was losing focus and feeling isolated. And then there was one night specifically where I stayed up all night writing in my journal. It was just like kind of manic writing. The conclusion of it was that I need help. This isn't normal. So I think I called my mom at 8 a.m. and I was like, I need help. And she's like, okay, we'll figure something out. And whenever I got off the phone with her, I think I just started hysterically crying to the point where I couldn't stop at all. You know, I was living with a bunch of other girls and my roommates came out and were like, try to ask me what was happening. And I couldn't even get words out. And it went on for multiple hours. It was maybe like 2 hours that I just couldn't. I was totally inconsolable and hysterical. And then finally, at that point, one of my roommates who had been on medication and seeing a psychiatrist basically gave me some anti-anxiety medicine and took me to her psychiatrist and got me on medication. And then I got assigned to a therapist through the school. And then the dean of the art school, which is the part of the university I was in, met with me and took me out of all of my classes and was like, you can't come back to school until, you know, your therapist thinks it's ready. You're ready for it. So yeah, kind of definitely like crash and burn style was how it manifested.
Right. Wow. And with the theme of this episode being perfectionism and you being in such an academic environment at this point, do you feel like that played into this crash?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, definitely. Just always want like, and especially because I was in art school where there isn't like right or wrong answers. It's just how much time you put into something. I mean, you could work on a project forever indefinitely and it can never be perfect. So I think that specifically was one of the factors that went into it of like, yes, wanting to be perfect, but then not having an end point. Like you can't just study for a test and then get 100. It's like you just keep going and going and going. But then that was also like kind of killing my creative side, where before it had always been, an outlet, it started becoming like a source of stress and anxiety as well.
Right. I can really see that. And particularly with subjects that are that more nonlinear way in nature,
yeah,
it can be easy for your perfectionist approach to just work you to the bone. And I very much look at a lot of things as almost like a bell curve, and that helps with my own perfectionism, that there does come a point where you've worked on something enough, and if you keep working on it, it'll actually get worse.
Yeah, totally. And then if you keep working on it, then you just kind of like drive yourself crazy. And then, but it's hard to know like when that point is really like, and then you keep thinking that like, well, if I work on it more, then it'll go back to it'll get a little better at some point, right? So, yeah.
Particularly, I would imagine when you're experiencing anxiety as well, that that's just causing a kind of doubling down on the flip side of perfectionism, that a lot of the time it can be viewed as something aspirational, like the default thing that people say in a job interview as one of their weaknesses. They'll say, oh, I'm a perfectionist, as if it's a good thing and like a cheat to that answer. But the flip side of it is how crippling it could be. You're striving for perfectionism, but you're also terrified of failure.
Right, yeah. A lot of times just figuring out where that line is, when it's done, when it's perfect, like what is perfect in the imperfections. That was something that I think, because I was also so young at the time, I wasn't able to really understand that, where it's something that I've gotten better at kind of understanding what the limitations are and being able to embrace them rather than try to fight against them.
Right, for sure. When you then did get the support from the psychiatrist, were you diagnosed with anxiety at that point, or did that come later?
I think I was just diagnosed with depression at that point. I feel like I was misdiagnosed and mismedicated because he saw me at like the lowest of low points when I'd been up all night and then had just hysterically cried for like 3 hours in a row and could barely function. So that was what he saw. So that's what he was diagnosing. So I don't really trust, there's not a lot I remember about like the specifics of that day. So I take that diagnosis a little bit with a grain of salt. Like, I don't think it was completely accurate.
Right. I can see that. And certainly that's one of the difficulties with mental illness as a whole. There can be so much crossover of symptoms that if you've then missed so many hours of sleep, it can just tip you into a different diagnosis quite easily.
Yeah. And also I was so young at the time, I didn't really have a set understanding of like what's normal or not normal. So I was kind of like, okay, I just kind of went along with whatever he was saying. Whereas I think as I got older, it got easier for me to see patterns and explain what I was going through more accurately because I had had so many more experiences under my belt too. So it was easier just for me to understand myself, to be able to explain it to a psychiatrist, to then get a more accurate, you know, diagnosis and medication.
For sure. Because I think that's one of the most challenging parts of mental illness, that there's so much pressure on the patient to be able to explain their symptoms and what they're going through, despite the fact that these conditions are also altering how your mind works and how you interact with people.
Totally.
It's always going to complicate things.
Mm-hmm.
And how did you find then continuing your studies and balancing these symptoms and also the perfectionism?
Well, I was taken out of school for 6 months or however long it was until I stabilized.
Right.
And then I went back to school, but I was only back in school, I want to say, for another, like, for like a semester after that. And then I kind of decided to take some time off of school, not because I wasn't doing well academically, but more because I just wanted to learn through experiences and not through a school setting. So I took a few years off and I moved to Los Angeles and, like, you know, worked at an art supply store and helped some people paint murals. So I did like a few traveled to Thailand. So I did just like some other stuff in between before I went back to finish school. And by that point, I was like 24, 25 when I did eventually go back to school to finish my undergraduate degree. And at that point, I just had a much better grasp of who I was and how much I could take and what studies I needed to do. And I took a lot of pressure off of mm-hmm. myself and kind of found the fun in art making again, which was really what I had been missing the first time. And I think I just did a lot better the second time around because I had taken some time to kind of understand myself a little bit more before completing my degree.
Right. I love that phrase, finding the fun, because I think that's the other side of how it can be challenging that there's not right and wrong in art in the way there is in other subjects like maths. But that's also where the joy is, that it can include your perspective and that be valid just because it's yours. It doesn't necessarily have to be a correct perspective in any way.
Yeah, and for me, it's like if I'm not enjoying it in some way, it shows in the work that you're doing too. So if something feels laborious while you're making it, it won't feel authentic, specifically with like my art and creative practice.
Yeah, I think that's pretty universal, to be honest, when it is something as subjective as art. You need the passion behind it really as part of the experience.
Yeah, and there is a lot of art history and historical context that goes into understanding how other people will read into it or understand it. So there is an academic part to it, but it still needs to be enjoyable for the maker.
Yeah, for sure. I don't know where this quote is from, but I've heard people say of studying art that you need to learn the rules so that you can learn how to meaningfully break them.
Right, yeah, totally.
What part of your experience would you like to talk about next?
I had several episodes after that one when I was 20. The most kind of impactful one, well, there's a few. Oh, okay. They kind of progressively got worse. I had just moved from San Francisco to Chicago, and then I moved into my apartment and started classes on the very same day. So it was like there's just a lot of change happening at once. And I had spent the last few years kind of just doing whatever I wanted to, like waiting tables, but like, you know, helping friends and their art projects, but just kind of nothing really serious. And so then like going back to school when it was easier when I was 25, it then became harder again when I was 29. And that was because I was like, I'm here because I want to be here, not just because I'm finishing something. So that put a huge amount of pressure on me. And I was like, I'm an adult. I'm paying for this. It's, you know, it's a professional degree. What does that mean? And then there were no parameters at all. Like when I thought there was like, we just had like one big project we had to like make by the end of the semester, and we would kind of meet with a teacher once a week. So there's all this time to second guess yourself, be not sure of what you're doing, and then wanting it to be good because, you know, you're a grown up now. And and then the move was really hard. And my boyfriend at the time, who's currently my husband, moved with me. And that was just challenging for both of us settling in together. And then I just kept working and working and working and not sleeping and not sleeping and not sleeping. And I finally had a breakdown again that was semi-similar to the one that I had had when I was 20. And I just wanted to take a break, and I didn't know how to pump the brakes on life. Right. But I did end up involuntarily committed to the psych ward because I went to a guidance counselor and I said the S word again, more like I was thinking about it. But then when they tested my blood, I had a bunch of, you know, chemicals in it. So I was there for 5 days. And again, they took me out of school. They made me go to a therapist. This time they didn't put me on medication because I was like, I don't want to be medicated. I've been mismedicated before and I don't want it. I can do this without medication. So yeah, so that was a very similar experience to the time when I was 20 in a lot of ways.
Yeah, well, it does sound very parallel, but this time it was even more ramped up.
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, the moving. And it was also surprising to me because I had felt like I had, at that point, had a handle on it because I had been able to navigate some of the symptoms of like anxiety and depression more easily before that. So when it happened, I was just kind of surprised. I was like, I thought I had figured this out and it wasn't going to happen again, you know? And clearly that was not the case. So I also felt like disappointed in myself that I had let it happen again. And I came out of that, you know, really determined. To me, that was like eye-opening too. And that was like, okay, I need to figure out how to actually get a handle on this. Spoiler alert, that didn't work either. So,
well, it's interesting hearing this because I'm sort of drawing my own parallels in my life that a lot of the time I use work still now, although I think I've got a better balance than when I was younger, but I certainly used work at some of my worst times as a distraction, that if I really focused on productivity and my own perfectionism through my work, then that felt productive even when my personal life wasn't going so well.
Yeah.
And so looking back on that, are you able to kind of draw the lines of, with you overworking so much, to what degree that was because of mental illness?
Yeah, I would say it was the overworking and then not being able to sleep, the kind of residue of working all the time. Someone who doesn't have anxious brain chemistry could, at the end of the day, put down their work and go to sleep. And for me, one of my first symptoms always of, you know, starting to spiral out a little bit is I don't sleep. So I could get myself to sleep, but then I would wake up every hour and I have anxiety dreams every single night, just about. And so like when it would get to its worst, I would, you know, fall asleep at, let's say, like midnight, but then wake up at 2 and then wake up at 3 and then finally wake up at 5, but not be able to fall back asleep. So I'm just like, well, I'm awake, so I'll start working again. So I think for me, it's more the inability to turn off my brain when I need to rest is really the biggest thing.
Yeah. And it sounds like your work then became the default go-to when you weren't feeling well as a way to still find something kind of productive to do when it's the middle of the night. And what else are you going to do if you can't sleep? And so through all this, you'd built up an immense level of experience of like how to manage your mental health, both in positive and maladaptive ways. At what point did you find the work that you're doing now? And how did that change things in terms of your work life?
Right. So that last breakdown that I had, they took me out of school again. I ended up not going back to school. I kind of felt like academic art was not what I was interested in. So I spent a few years kind of, you know, I started a community garden. I got married. I, you know, just kind of did some life things. And then I think it was like a year or two after that I started Steel Petal Press, which is my greeting card company. And there I felt like the kind of drive for perfectionism and the work ethic helped my business succeed and excel, because you really have to put a lot of work and thought and time and energy into starting a business and maintaining a business and making sure that it's, you know, growing and sustainable. And so I did work a lot for that, but I didn't feel like it necessarily started getting out of control until my most recent episode, which was when I had opened a retail shop. So, which first of all made it so that there was a place that I had to be during certain hours or certain days in order to keep it open. And then I had more staff working for me. And then we're going into the holiday season, so having a retail shop during Christmas is just bonkers. During that time, it was right around the 2016 elections in America, which were traumatic for a lot of people. And then the woman who had been like my right hand, who had been working for me for a few years, ended up in a coma because she just had some weird form of meningitis. So I basically ended up running the retail shop, doing her job, being there 16 hours a day for many, many weeks in a row just to make sure it would be up and running and continue running. And at the end of it all, I just had a total meltdown, similar to what had happened the other times, because I had been, you know, just overworking myself and had no more reserves. And it was at that point that I decided to go back to a psychiatrist to be like, okay, all of the things that I tried to do before, like getting out of school or moving out of a living situation that was causing anxiety. I was like, the world I have built for myself is anxiety inducing and there's no way out of it. And so running a small business, it creates a lot of stress and anxiety. So that was when I finally decided to go back to a psychiatrist and explain to them all the history up until that point, as I understood it as how old was I at the time? As a 36-year-old instead of a 20-year-old, I felt like I could more accurately portray what had been going on. And so, yeah, so at that point I got medication and which has helped a lot. And yeah, I kind of had to figure out how to better construct a business in my life that would be more long-term sustainable, so I wouldn't burn myself out.
Right. Because it sounds like the easy default you'd found was just constantly putting more pressure on yourself. And so when you no longer had that right-hand woman to support you, you just automatically took on her work almost without maybe just even deciding to. That's just what you automatically did.
Well, and the work needed to get done, so someone had to do it. And I'm also like a little bit of a workaholic and can find escape in my work because it is something that kind of does give my life some purpose, which was something that I had felt like I had been lacking prior to that too. So something that I'm really passionate about that I can put into the world is what makes me want to get up every day and, you know, continue to do things. So I kind of latched onto that also as something that was purposeful and also an escape.
For sure. And one of the things I really love about your work is how you've now found ways to put your understanding of mental health into what you create as well. So would you mind sharing a little bit about that and particularly the mood trackers?
Yeah. So specifically, it was only once I got a better handle on what my situation was, I felt like I could talk about it publicly. I think prior to this, when I was still going through the struggle and not really understanding what my issues were, how to help, like up until the 2016, 2017, when I got medicated and really was able to get good perspective on what I was doing. So it started from that of just, I would like to talk about this publicly now that I feel like I understand it. And then wanted, because I had Steel Pedal Press as a business and a platform, and there's so many people who have small businesses or you look at someone with a small business, you're like, oh, everything must be great. And it's just what's happening in the background, nobody really knows about too. It's like you have a thriving business, but, you know, maybe you're struggling with depression or anxiety. You can't get up get up to go to work some days. So I really wanted to use Steel Pedal Press is a platform to talk about it. And I wanted to create a product that would directly relate to my experience and what I had gone through. And that also could be useful. I didn't want to do inspirational quote or something like that, just because I feel like it can be trite when you're actually going through it. So I wanted something that could also be a tool. So yeah, so the mood tracker is kind of just a way to write down what you're going through so that you can better understand it and maybe be able to afterwards take a step back and be able to look at it logically. So we have an anxiety tracker where you write down what's happening, what's the trigger, what can you do about it. You have a self-care checklist, which, you know, goes from the basics of just, you know, getting out of bed, eating meals, to journal or do something fun or get it outside and get fresh air. And then one that's nightly notes. which is, you know, tracking at the end of the day what your hopes are and what you did through the day, and other different trackers that are along that style. So the idea is that it's a product where, like, on the back, I can tell a little bit about my story, but then also it's something that can be used every day as a way to, you know, better your mental health. It can be a tool in your toolbox of ways to kind of cope with living with any type of mental illness.
Right. I really love that. And I think that's really important, that depending on your level of mental health, there are different tools. So I think, certainly speaking for myself, generally really good days, motivational quotes are great. But then on the worst days, you just can't relate to them. They just don't make sense anymore. and so it's really great to have these practical tools. And also, I love the tracking element. It means you can kind of draw these insights from your own experience, because so often we do have to have an element of our own input in mental health. You know, there is no magic pill, there's no magic therapy that allows us to not do any work and yet be much better.
Yeah. And I think also you can, like the idea is that, like, if you just want to put a day behind you, it's easier if you write it down, you kind of get it out of you, and then you can, like, throw it, be like, I'm done with that. Yeah. Otherwise, it can sometimes just spiral in your head over and over again. Especially if you have anxiety, then you're just like, you can overthink every little detail. But once it gets out on paper, it's easier to kind of move past it also.
Yeah, that's so true. It somehow shrinks it, like seeing it on the page. It somehow seems smaller than it shouting inside your mind.
Totally.
I love that. So that's a good place to wrap up then. So if people want to learn more about you and your work, hopefully go on and purchase a few things as well, where should they go?
So my website is where you can see, like, a little bit about who we are. We also have a mental health page there, and that's where we mostly do greeting cards, but we also have the mental health trackers and other home goods and stuff like that. And it's steelpetalpress.com. So steel is in the metal and petal as in flower petal, press.com. And then across social media, we're just at Steel Petal Press, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter.
Brilliant. And I'll put a link for the website in the episode description as well. Okay, that's us coming to an end of our time. But it's been so lovely chatting to you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.